Welcome to Radio Free South Africa with your host, Skalkfa Nomerva, and myself, Karen Smith. And our guest for the first hour today is Zelie Oxlew-Dupré from South African Family Relief Project. For those new listeners that have not heard of Lee, Lee is the director of South African Family Relief Project, which is a charity which helps all the people, the white people, in the squatter camps in South Africa. She's also purchasing a farm where they have put up houses and they have rescued people from the camps and are rehabilitating them and putting them back into society. Welcome, Skalk. Your mic is muted, Skalk.
Yes, I'm on. My apologies. Now I see Lee's also on. Yes, thank you very much for the introduction as usual. And I think it's going to be a very interesting program, highlighting the softer and the sadder part of what the South African white experience is currently, relating to the poverty levels and the dire situation that many of our people find themselves in.
Yes. For me, Lee is one of the superheroes of this fight that the South Africans are in, because for me, I can talk about it, I can read about it, but she's involved in it every single day and has to look in the faces of those people and say, I have no food for you today, sorry, or I don't have any money, so I can't get you to the doctor or the dentist today. That must be one of the most heartbreaking things that can ever happen.
Yes, indeed. And Lee, I see you're also on. Yes, thank you very much for making time for us and being on our show. As always, it's a huge privilege and an honor to have you on.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. And it's a great honor to be on your show.
Thank you, Karen. If I can kick off, I just want to give the background to why we are sitting with the situation that we're having in South Africa. And that relates directly to legislation from government. It's not by incident that we are sitting with the poverty levels so very high amongst the white population. It's by design, and designed through legislation, actual legislation by government that's embodied mostly in two sets of legislation. The one being the black empowerment legislation that basically bars black white people from doing business. In other words, in a managerial or ownership level in the economy. And the second part is the Employment Equity Act that basically bars white people from the job market. And if they are in the job market, it bars them from any advancement in the workplace, promotion, etc. So that's where this comes from. It's not by mistake, or it's not because of economic downturn or whatever. It's by design of the government that disempowers white people from the economy. And that has caused white squatter camps to spring up. And even beyond that, the lower portion, the lower classes of white society to become highly impoverished in South Africa. Lee, maybe from your side, what is your experience of this?
Well, I see the outcome of the BEE and the fact that our folks can't find employment. I see the direct result of what's happening with our folks, and it's the middle class. Even the middle class are now affected. It used to only be, the lower class folks. But now, especially in the last 2 years or so, I've seen that the middle class is greatly affected as well. We've got families that are starting to move back to mom and dad, with their children, to grandma and grandpa, just in order to survive. Or the elderly, moving in with their children because it's just impossible to live on the pension fund, if at all they do get. And then for the most part, we find families that grandma, grandpa, mother, father, and children need rescuing. So it is really become a dire situation. And talk about more and more and more camps and more people that are able. And it's heartbreaking, you know, to see a family that.
I think Lee is breaking up a little bit, but I think what she's describing to us is the practical issue on the ground. I travel a lot, and I travel through very affluent areas.
And people want to work.
Yeah, Lee, you're breaking up quite badly. Lee, just hold on. Skulk, you were saying you travel a lot.
No, I travel a lot, and sometimes I travel through extremely affluent areas, most notably Sandton, for instance, Rosebank in Johannesburg, many parts in Pretoria. Still, Eastern Pretoria is a very rich area. So for the traveler from abroad, for the tourist, it's sometimes difficult to understand what we are saying, because that is the only face of South Africa that they see. They will let at O.R. Tambo International Airport, a tremendously well-designed and built and modern airport. And then they would travel to hotels in these affluent areas of South Africa. But they do not see what's going on ground level, what Lee is seeing, and I'm also seeing when I travel to the outreaching areas and to the lower income areas, because it's there where this is now taking place. I sometimes get a little bit of blowback when I speak to foreigners about this aspect. And they say to me, but when we drive through South Africa, it's all BMWs and Mercedeses on the streets. And it's these extremely rich suburbs that we travel through. But it's because they only see a very small proportion of what is actually going on in the South African landscape. Leah, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Maybe your comments on this?
Well, yes, I agree with you. What they don't realize is it might be an affluent suburb, but in behind closed doors, these folks are struggling. You know, they've had to take in their children, and it's not easy. And they are the lucky ones, because it takes one paycheck and they can lose absolutely everything. Lose their jobs, lose their house, lose their car, and end up where the other folks are ending up. You know, it happens so quickly. It's actually scary.
Yeah, so South Africans are highly in credit also. You will very rarely find that the person will be able to buy a house or a car or whatever he needs for just his physical substance and survival through the day in cash. Usually that is financed through credit. And you're quite right. It takes one, maybe 2 months, and the person can lose literally everything that he's had for his whole life. Yes. Karen, I cut you off, I think.
No, not really. What I was thinking is that we actually need to talk about the problems, that there's no space in the camps that do exist. So the people who are now losing their jobs or have lost their jobs and have now lost everything, if they're lucky enough to have a car, they live in the car in the bush. But if they've lost that as well, then what are they doing? I mean, Lee, I've read stories and heard from you about families living under a piece of tarpaulin in the bush, which is extremely dangerous, but they can't find a camp to take them.
Yes, still now. I mean, in Elandspoort, we visited last week. There are still people living in the bush, but now the number has grown where, you know, there are children. It used to only be, you know, adults, but now there are children living with these the adults, with the parents. So, and it's heartbreaking to see. These children can't go to school. They can't even afford, you know, many times a loaf of bread for the day. So they hide the children because they cannot afford to buy school clothes, buy books, pay school fees. And the children, are hidden during the day because there's no ways of them sending them to school. And the parents have to fend for food. So it's a very sad situation. And it's not easy to rectify the problem because, as we speak now, I have to go to the school. We have three children that are in our camp or on our farm project that is in school. And they are not allowed to get their, reports because both the parents of each child are unemployed, and have not been paying the school fees, which means that the children cannot get their reports.
Yeah, but that's tremendously against the interest of the child. Never mind the parents. I'm shocked when I hear these things. It's a practical thing that they experience, but I'm shocked. In other words, Lee. So that child will not even be able to know whether they pass their grades or their standards or whatever their tests because of the financial position of their parents.
Of both parents. And I especially took the parents to the police station so that they could make affidavits. But now they say that the parents has to go to each and every bank in South Africa, Standard Bank, FNB, Absa, all the banks, and get a written letter that they do not have a bank account in order to prove that they are unemployed. And then from there on, they can only apply for state assistance. But in the meantime, these children cannot get their reports. And we actually got a letter on that today. So I'm trying desperately. I'm going to have to go and see the school and beg the school and see if we cannot make some kind of a plan in order for the children to get their certificates. Because, I mean, they've really worked hard, and penalizing the children for the parents' financial status is unfair, I feel. Unfortunately, yeah. This is what we have to deal with every day. In government schools or in South Africa.
Yes. Yeah, and there's no way of even thinking of putting these children into private schools, which will, of course, be much more expensive. So they are basically, they have to go to the government school, and if those are the rules of the school, it's the rules. I know Gauteng province, not so much where I live in the Free State, but Gauteng province, also have a very large problem relating to the placement of children. There's not enough schools for all the children.
Yes,
obviously, exactly. If a child can't even get his report, his school's report, how can that child then apply for next year for a placement? Which basically means that child is going to fall out of the system. Am I correct in saying that?
Exactly. Yes, you are 100% correct. But at the same time, in South Africa, it is illegal to not have your child in school. So the parents are in a catch-22 situation that the state, doesn't help or assist these poverty-stricken parents and children with free education or subsidies. And it's horrible. And, I actually went to the clinic with a woman, the one lady who does not want to have another child. They are without employment. They are living in a camp. We took them to the clinic. The clinic is refusing to do a sterilization for the mum. At the same time, she then asked for contraception. No contraception. I have to buy contraception at the pharmacy because the state clinics do not have contraception, and they are also refusing to sterilize the woman. So they are being failed left, right, anywhere, which way they turn.
Yes, it's always these contradictions. Myself and Karen, we all often speak to our guests about the contradictions that we as white folks have to deal with. Because on the one hand, you can go to prison for not sending your child to school, but on the other hand, it's impossible for you to place them in a school. So what must you do now? It's one of those contradictions that has no outcome. And Karen also highlighted a very, very critical issue, and that is the physical space, the physical land available for these people to go and live on. You would see black squatters, and this is not being racist. We see it every day in our news media. I'm just simply observing and relaying what I observe. So it's not racism. We see black squatters being resettled on a huge, tremendous scale. When I travel up from the Free State to Johannesburg, just south of Soweto. Now Soweto is a big, sprawling, tremendously big, sprawling black area, southwestern townships. But even to the south of that, to the Grasmere area, there is now squatters. I don't know where they came from. In a matter of less than 6 months, maybe less than 6 months, there's a whole new squatter area, black squatter area, which is tremendously big, that has sprung up. And those people are not removed. It takes the landowner quite a substantive amount of money, time, and effort to go to court and get the court order, and then usually the court order can't be enforced. So those people, those black people, have settled. They simply struck up their little makukus there, and they are living there. But the white squatters can't do that. The moment the white squatter, once again, these contradictions that the white people face, the moment that the white squatter will do that, they will be evicted overnight. So where do these people actually go and live? And I think you experience the same, that you now sit with people living in Wendy houses. Wendy house in South Africa is a small wooden hut. Usually it was in the olden days, it was where you put your garden tools in. That's what a Wendy house is. Many people are living in those little Wendy houses at the back of their already impoverished family. That is where they can live. But that space is also limited. It's also going to run out at some point in time. And then where are those people are going to go? You've bought a farm now, and maybe you can resettle people on a farm. But once again, you don't even have infrastructure there. The government is not going to build you infrastructure. So what do we do with the people that come into here? Yes, Lee?
But they also restrict you. You know, we have a 2 hectare. It's not, you know, huge, but they restrict you on the number of people that you are allowed, or the number of dwellings that you are allowed to put up. So, barring from putting people in tents, I can only put up a certain amount of housing. They do not want to allow us to put more in order to, thus we have a waiting list of people coming to our farm. You know, and there aren't many of them around. I mean, Dirk van Philadelphia Ark and a few others are really desperately trying to accommodate these people. But for the most part, these people are left to their own devices and they're out on the street. And they've got nowhere to go.
And Lee, what happens to the people, and especially the women folk and the children? I've come across a terrible situation where many of these children and women now become part of the sex industry, the sex trade in South Africa. Is that also your experience?
Oh, dear.
Yes. Because of the poverty. And so they are groomed at a very early age to make money for the household, you know, and that's how they are keeping them alive. Also with regards to drug and alcohol abuse, it is rampant. And that's very, very heartbreaking and sad. And unfortunately with us, we do not take in any folks that are already dependent, because they already have a setback. Emotionally, financially, and you know, we are not equipped to handle you know, situations like that. So we do work very, very narrowly with the social services, and we look out for signs of any, you know, child trafficking. And you will not believe that I get calls from all over asking us to find children to be adopted, and we cannot get involved in in things like that, they have to go through the legal channels of either fostering, registering as a foster parent, and then applying for adoption. And I can understand where the folks are coming from. They're trying to rescue these children. But unfortunately, the state's mandates are that any child that has been removed from the parents for whatever reason has to be returned, and the parents have to be rehabilitated. Thus, we are sitting with children in foster care, thousands and thousands of them, and they cannot go to proper homes because the state's mandate is that the children have to go back to the parents.
Now that it's a terrible situation that we are facing. It's terrible. In other words, this has now become generational. We're not dealing with only one generation suffering from the poverty and all the implications of that. We're sitting with at least one, maybe a second generation already that's been caught up there. So we're dealing with a deal. Yes?
Yes.
Yes, Lee?
Definitely two generations because, parents and children are affected by the laws, and we see how much the parents and children are suffering. And then you've got a third generation, the older people who are victimized and killed and slaughtered on the farms, especially if they are elderly people because of the apartheid. They specifically target them. So I can assure you that definitely two generations are affected at this stage. Because if you look at the parents not finding jobs and the children not being schooled or educated properly or having a proper home to live in and shoes to wear and a plate of food to eat every night, it's not there.
Now, Lee, let's be realistic about this whole thing. We're seeing exactly the same problem, but in numbers so much bigger in the black community also. They are also sitting in squatter camps. They are also sitting in a situation that they can't find work. Now, that is not because of laws. That is because of the laws creating the economic downturn. I want to footnote that because I want to explain to the listeners what I mean by that. But we're sitting with the black population experiencing exactly the same. They are also now generationally impoverished. It's not going to get better. So the point that I'm really trying to make is after 94, not the white people and definitely also not the black people have actually moved ahead, have actually had any benefit of the so-called New South Africa, of the so-called Rainbow That's Nation. Correct. Everybody is now poor. Whereas previously, at least a section of the population was not poor, and they could then channel that money and the taxes and so forth to look after the very poor black people. That is also starting to become impossible. We're sitting with a treasury that is so empty that schooling and most of the social services are falling behind. Our hospitals are falling behind. Because there's not enough money coming into the treasury. So in other words, everybody is now poor. It was definitely not a redistribution of wealth. It was a redistribution of poverty that happened in South Africa.
Yes.
I just want to come back to that. I want to come back to that footnote. There's a very big court case now in South Africa relating to a bank. It's called Capitec Bank, which by law was forced to take in a black partnership, a black holding into that company. And now they're sitting with a problem that the holdings is held by the Gupta family, which are normally black in South Africa, although they are foreign Indian people, but they hold a substantive part of this bank's shareholding. And they have now become persona non grata in South Africa. There's investigations in the US even against them, and now they must sell off that part of the shareholding. And now Capitec Bank is sitting in the dire straits that if it is sold onto a so-called white company or white owners, then they may lose their banking license. That is how dire and how contradicting these laws are. So through the laws, white people are directly being discriminated and taken out of the economy, and black people indirectly because of these policies. You can elaborate from your side.
I agree with you 100%. The other thing that we also have to take into account is the fact that we have an influx of Africans coming in from other countries who are working for less than what, or prepared to work for much less than what our South African counterparts would work for. So they are also exploiting the job market. And we have, about 53 million black South Africans, and we have an additional 30-odd million, Africans coming in from other countries. So that has also a huge impact on the ordinary South African black person finding employment. And it also raises the crime. It has a huge impact on the economy because of the lack of employment for our own black people. So yes, you are 100% correct. We have more black squatter camps and more black people in poverty than we have ever had in the history of South Africa.
Yes, exactly. Percentage-wise, you can also see that for the Americans, 5% or 7% even, unemployment is a tremendously, tremendously high unemployment rate. It causes such shock that it can cause a government to fall, which basically happened to the Obama administration. The nominally high unemployment rate of the Obama administration caused the Trump administration to come after that. Now, we're speaking here of 5 to 7%. In South Africa, in certain areas, the unemployment number is between 30 to 60% of the population. In other words, in some areas, 6 out of 10 people that can be employed, that's still in the age group of employment, are sitting at home. They are not employed. 60% of your employable population is not working. Now, how is that sustainable? We know it's not sustainable, and that is why the whole mechanism of state is now imploding. We're seeing it every day imploding around us. And the sad part of all this is, Ramaphosa can go on television and tell us all these very nice stories of all the investments coming in. Those investments are not coming in because there's fundamental problems with the economy. No sane business person from America or from Europe or from wherever will put money into this country at this point. So we're facing that fiscal cliff. It's going to cave in front of us. We're going to fall. That is my observation of these things. I don't know if you disagree with me.
Oh, no, I agree 100%. We're already seeing it happen. I mean, the state is failing. State departments are failing dismally. Look at your healthcare. Look at the education. Those two alone are in dire need of funding. And there are none. Our hospitals are falling apart. Our doctors have left. There's no ways that you can sugarcoat it. We are done for at this stage when we look at the government departments that are still sort of running.
Yes, sort of running. I think there's no one of them at this point that is not dysfunctional, at least to a certain extent. And most of them is not even dysfunctional. It's there's simply no service delivery at all. Karen, from your side, I know you always look at the more human side of this whole thing, the human suffering because of this. From your side, what are your comments on this?
Well, you know, Skulk, Lee told me a story recently about trying to get birth certificates for some of these children. Now, you're talking about government departments that are dysfunctional. Lee, if you could just tell that story of how you struggled to get the birth certificates, to get those children into school, and now they can't get their certificates.
Yeah, well, first of all, I took them, and we stood in line for I don't know how long, eventually get to the counter, and then they wanted both parents. I said, well, you know, it's not possible for us to bring both parents just to get a birth certificate. As far as I know, the only time both parents have to sign is when you want a passport issued to a minor child. Fighting with that, and then they wanted the proof of residence. I had to run around, rally around for proof of residence. They gave us so much flack in order to get these children's birth certificates. The frustration level that day went through the roof, because and then you get somebody else in front of you, who does not have those documents, a proof of residence and whatnot. And they get their birth certificate printed out immediately.
Sure. No.
So you can see the discrimination just at these departments, that these folks have to go through.
And Lee, but, the other thing
you I know, want, just got repeated.
The other thing I'd really like you to talk about, you did talk about birth control. Now, one of the things that we always hear, you post pictures of handing out plates of food and jerseys and blankets and things to the people in the camps. And the comments always make me want to vomit. Why do they have so many children? Why is that one pregnant? Why? You must live with this. I mean, I see it on social media. I don't live with it. But the comments are so nasty about these people and their children. And yet, as you said earlier, they can't get birth control. They cannot, they can't afford to go and buy it. They can't get it from the clinics, and the clinics refuse to sterilize them. So could you speak about the nastiness that fundraising for these people brings in?
Well, that's the red tape that we encounter every day. Most people don't understand that 2 months ago, they were living in a house. Mom was maybe at home, or dad was at home and mom was working, and they were okay. And all of a sudden, creditors come knocking at the door. They're taking the house. You have to move. In a blink of an eye,
they're on the streets, totally on the streets. And so the mom was pregnant, and they did have two or three children. And now, because we try and fundraise for them,
we are in such a situation. Exactly. And so,
yeah, South African internet is wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful.
It comes and goes. And Karen, it's not only on our show. I was on a show in Australia about 2 weeks ago, and often about
what,
an hour.
2-3 months ago. Yeah.
We experienced exactly the same. So it's not a South Africa America thing. It's a general problem that we face here. So yes, apologies to our listeners. Go ahead, Lee. I think you're on again.
Sorry. You know, a heavily pregnant mom, but 6 months ago, they were living okay. They were managing. They were surviving. But today, it's all gone. All gone.
And people.
So what does she do with the baby? I mean, it's absolutely unfair. Most people don't understand how fast it can happen. And if you are living barely day to day, trying to survive, and you, like I said to just now, if you lose that paycheck can determine whether you are out on the street tomorrow, or whether you can still survive for another month.
And Lee, I think you also just brush past the subject of if you get any state help. I think you need to explain how difficult it is for white people who are on the streets to get any kind of social grants in South Africa.
Well, first of all, you can go to the offices. The first thing that I would ask you is proof of identity. And many of them have either lost it or it has expired, and they haven't had the money to replace or go for a new one. So, but if you are lucky enough and you do have an ID document, then you have to prove a place of residence. Well, if you live in a shack, in a squatter camp, you do not have a proof of residence. Finding a proof of residence is impossible. And if you cannot prove where you stay with a utility bill, electricity or refuse or an account that goes to that specific address, you cannot get assistance.
And so you can hardly say, I live under the third tree on the left-hand side of this country road. I mean, that you know, or even in, if you're in a camp, even then you don't have electricity, you don't have water, you don't have bills.
Substation, you don't have any of that.
No. So essentially you are done for because it is rigged against you, but somehow the black people manage to get it living in the same kind of circumstances.
Yes, they do.
Karen, I think it's also a tremendous struggle for them. But yes, I think they've become more acclimatized to this whole system as we have done. We're not supposed to be in the system. But when I listen to the two of you discussing this, are we not discussing what is actually a refugee problem? If you look at displaced persons in Syria now, I looked at the video not long ago of that little girl. Her name is Angel in Arabic, and where they interviewed her. What you are describing is exactly the same as what those people in Syria, in a hot war zone, being refugees and being displaced. It's exactly the same as what they are experiencing. So we are actually dealing with what the UN might call a humanitarian and refugee problem. That is already in South Africa.
But Skulp, nobody's looking at it. They refuse. I mean, how many groups have been to the UN and asked for assistance, asked them to send a task force to come and have a look, asked them to please do something about it. And somehow those requests just get shelved. And they refuse, they and Amnesty International absolutely refuse to do anything about it. So
it's a humanitarian crisis because the numbers aren't there.
Well, the numbers are in fact there, but I think the whitewashing of what's going on in South Africa is so tremendously strong in the international arena that they simply don't believe us when we tell them these things. And there's a reason why I say the numbers are great enough, and I'm not disagreeing with you just simply for the reason of disagreeing. Myself and Karen is going to speak in the second half of this program about actual war zones and casualties of wars.
I love the internet when it works, but when it doesn't, it's an absolute pain in the dais. Yeah, Lee, we're going to talk about that numbers afterwards, because in reality, South Africa is worse off than any war zone. The numbers just tell you that. And yet nobody will look at it. And yes, the white numbers.
Those numbers of casualties into the poverty rating in South Africa. If 60%, let's make it 50% refugees in their own land.
Absolutely, absolutely, Skulk. And if you look at the unemployment numbers amongst young blacks, they are hitting 60%, which the government has missed to. Never mind, we have got some incredible feedback here. Oh, the government admits to it, so the figures are probably much higher than that. And then, again, you look at the 30% that one requires to pass a subject in school, so that makes you unemployable anyway because all you got was 30%, although you've passed. It's an incredible number of unemployed and unemployable people in South Africa. It is a humanitarian crisis, and the people should be refugees, instead of which Zimbabweans are the refugees flooding into the country and making the situation worse.
Yes, exactly. And I think Lee also spoke about that problem of the foreigners coming in. Lee, on a strictly charitable or charity basis, do you think that the foreigners are putting undue pressure onto the system even more so than it already was?
Oh yes, definitely, because you have charities that are solely now looking for, especially from overseas, the UK, that are feeling sorry for the folks from Zimbabwe that are fleeing to South Africa for a better life, and they are focusing on Zimbabwe and helping Zimbabweans because of what is going on in their country instead of looking at South Africans and what's happening here. So Zimbabwe is definitely taking off some of the focus of impoverished or poverty of South Africans because of the dire situation that Zimbabwe is facing currently.
And now we was also acknowledged to one another that situation is also not getting better. It is deteriorating by the day. I mean, when we start speaking about Zimbabwe a couple of months ago, after Mugabe's demise there, things could have gone a little bit better. But once again, the fundamentals were not in place. So no economy can just by miracle all of a sudden improve to a point that the people are actually employed and things start looking up. And now we know it's not gotten better. In fact, it's gotten worse to the extent that they themselves acknowledge, even in the mainstream media, that Zimbabwe is basically imploding, that the state mechanism has imploded or is imploding. So that situation is not going to get better. It's going to get worse.
Yeah, Africa, as far as I know, and I mean South Africa.
Yeah, South Africa is following those footsteps, absolutely. I think that's what Lee was about to say. Is that South Africa is no better off because
Our own economy is struggling.
Exactly. And it's getting worse by the minute. Skulk and I will discuss that in the second hour as well, the number of companies leaving, which just puts a greater strain on it. And then you have the added problem. From my point of view, I watch it in the USA. If charities are going to send any money or any goods or anything to South Africa, it is to the little black kids. Nobody worldwide is helping the white squatters because they're a well-hidden story. And if you tell people about it, they don't believe you. As Skulk said, they doubt your veracity. So getting help for the whites in these circumstances is almost impossible.
Yes, exactly. And once again, it goes about the focus of who the problem are. So sometimes you will even find people to say, but yeah, it's the white people deserve what they're getting now. Let them also be poor. But a hungry child is a hungry child. Whether that child is black or green or whatever color, it doesn't matter. A hungry child is a hungry child. There's no white guilt on that person or apartheid guilt on that child.
Yes. Apartheid
has been dead for 40 years, not even 25 years, 40 years it's been dead. And those children are still being judged. Yeah, but it's actually your own mistake that you are in the situation that you are. It's not. We inherited the mistakes of F.W. de Klerk and Mandela. We inherited it. We never put ourselves into this position willingly. But we can discuss that in the second part also. But it's the practical problem of those children are hungry. Doesn't matter what color they are. They are hungry. They've basically become sex slaves just simply by virtue of their skin color.
Yeah.
Let it go on.
Lee is leaving us in about 10 minutes. So, Lee, if you would do a quick roundup and tell people how they can help or how they can donate, we can maybe try and get some help for you before the Christmas season, which is coming up fast. And these children really deserve one day a year, just one day a year, where they get fed, they get a present, they have a bit of a laugh, they have some fun, and then they can go back to their poverty circumstances. But at least we try. We try every year to bring them some Christmas joy.
Yes. Well, they can donate to Radio Free South Africa. You guys have always been absolutely amazing in sending the funds over to us when we have dire, dire need. We really do need to purchase a new generator very urgently because our generator is backing up and we are completely off the grid. So we are solely reliant on the borehole water. And our generator has done so many hours and hours and hours of work. And if I don't have water, I am not able to cook or let the children bath. So I'm desperately looking out for a new generator that is dire. And then, of course, you know, food items and you know, fun so that I can make sure that these children and families have, like you said, Karen, one day in the year where we can celebrate the birth of Christ and be thankful for being together at least and not being out in the street all on our own and having some laughter for a change, because laughter is non-existent in many of these families' lives. And we want the children to have some fun and not having the parents to worry for that one day about where a plate of food is going to come from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lee, I noticed that you're also working together with another organization to a certain extent these days. It's called Toekoms Fonk, literally Future Spark, if you know. Just in short, tell us who those people are and the affiliation, where do they come from, and maybe we can even assist.
Well, Toekoms Fonk was
started
by Mark Gerber, Ingrid Botha, and Steve Hofmeyer. They have been absolutely amazing folks. From the moment that I met them a few years ago, these women are powerhouse women. They have helped us put up a tunnel. They
okay. So,
and I'm in dire need of food. I can always contact them, and they will come with a load of food. They've been absolutely amazing group of people, and they do help the communities all around South Africa.
Okay, what I propose is that we do maybe a little bit of marketing for yourself directly to your organization, but then also involve Toekoms Fonk in the future, because they have the backing of Steve Hofmeyer, and Steve Hofmeyer being a very well-known personality in South Africa, it's always going to be more easy in South Africa at least to generate goodwill for your organization. Correct. Maybe not overseas to that extent, but we can definitely also involve them in future.
Yeah, well, Toekoms Fonk, last week or the week before, Maurice and I, my husband and I, were invited to the 1 year celebration of Toekoms Fonk, and they handed us a security system with beams, 8 or 9 cameras. It's an amazing gift, because we stay in rural area. They gave us this fantastic gift, and they delivered it now Saturday with a load of food. And I can tell you, these women are really, really wonderful, wonderful working women. They've done amazing work for the community, and I stand behind them 100%.
we will have one of them on the show soon, Lee. But in the meantime, in order to donate, please go to radiofreesouthafrica.com and you can donate on my site. And please mark it for South Africa because I collect money for asylees in the United States as well. So please mark it for the children or for South Africa. And as Lee has just told you, it goes to them. You can be assured that it will go directly to Lee. And Lee's charity do not take salaries. They do not take a penny out of it. All of the money goes where it's supposed to go. Lee, thank you very, very much for coming on. I know you could only do an hour. The ads are about to run, and we will be back in about 6 minutes. Thank you, Lee.
Thank you for having me. God bless.
Thanks, Lee. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Lee. Bye.
You're listening to Radio Free South Africa with your hosts, Skalk van der Merwe, and myself, Karen Smith. Before the break, we had Lee Oxley-Dupre from South African Family Relief Project, who explained a little of what the problems are in South Africa and how difficult it is for anybody, white, black, pink, yellow, green, to survive. And at the same time, our wonderful president, President Ramaphosa, is going around the world with his begging bowl out and telling people that South Africa is open for business. And it's a wonderful place to invest. But at the same time, Skalk, how many companies are closing down, paying off a staff, especially parastatal companies? The situation gets worse by the hour.
Yes, Karen, two practical examples I've heard only since Sunday. SIA announced that they will be letting go about 1,000 of their staff members, SIA South African Airways, and then the huge steel mills at Saldanha in the Cape. The numbers there range between 900 and 2,000 people that will be laid off. But you must remember that if you're speaking about a steel plant, you're also then speaking of those mines that produce the ore that is refined in the plant. So in other words, if there's no refinery anymore, what's going to happen with the ore? What's going to happen with the mine? So there's definitely going to be mine closures in Sishen and Katu also. So only since Sunday, only big companies, mainstream media that we know about 3,000, 4,000 people to lose their jobs. High-paying jobs, good jobs, SIA, South African Airways, steel mills, we're speaking good jobs. Yes, it's on an hourly basis that we hear shock and horror stories coming through now, even mainstream as caught up, where they really start to acknowledge that we have serious problems. Now, Ramaphosa is going around and he's managed to have $300 billion dollars of investments, pledges of investments coming to South Africa. Let's be really realistic about this. For a foreign company to come and invest and build in South Africa, building cars, building whatever, it doesn't matter. They're going to need certain things. And one of the most important things is going to be energy, going to be electricity. And our main utility, the monopoly utility in South Africa producing electricity is Eskom, and Eskom is failing. Not even failing small time, failing big time, literally caving in. We've had rolling blackouts now for many years. They can't solve that because the capacity of electricity going to the grid is just too big, too small to really satisfy the demand on the system. Therefore, we have rolling blackouts in South Africa. Now, how can you come and build a plant as a foreign company, a plant in South Africa, facing that problem alone? That's going to tell the investor, I can't do that. So in other words, he can tell us a lot of lies, and he can tell the rest of the media and even the outside world a lot of lies. I cannot see that there will be direct foreign investment to huge extents into South Africa as we have it now. On the local level, businesses are closing down on a daily basis because they simply can't pay the huge expenses that we see as business people. It's impossible. You can't pay it. So I cannot foresee a dramatic upturn in the economy. Many of the economists came out last week and said, yeah, but it will take this and that and the following, and then overnight the thing will stabilize itself. It's not going to stabilize itself. And I'm not being a doom prophet when I say these things. I'm just simply being practical as a person who knows how business works. I've come out of a family of business people, of lawyers. We know how these things work, and we speak amongst one another. I come out of organized business. I was a business leader. I'm still a business leader for many years in elected positions in organized business. We speak amongst one another, and there's a reason why South African companies are not investing in South Africa, rather taking their money overseas, because that is a safe haven for them. If it was feasible to invest in South Africa, why go through all the pain and all the suffering and all the red tape of getting your money out of South Africa? You would have invested it here. It's not happening. So why would a foreign company then come in and with large-scale massive investments in South Africa? So no, I cannot foresee that there's going to be a substantive upturn in the economy. And if the economy falls, the treasury falls. And if the treasury falls, there's no grant for the poor people anymore. There's no state mechanism running and keeping the country afloat. So we're literally looking at failed state status in a couple of months, if not in a couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. And then on top of that, we have the expropriation without compensation, which means why would you come to South Africa to invest this money knowing that your property could be taken away any minute? Because that is not just farmland, and it's not just your home. It's everything. So you put up some enormous building and start a company with a factory going and what, and then the state says, okay, we need to take this away from you now. We're going to expropriate it without compensation. Why would anybody with half a brain in their head want to go and invest there?
Exactly, Karen, exactly. It's these contradictions, once again, with no outcome, because they are not supposed to make sense. So on the one hand, you have a drive from the governing party in South Africa, and it's going to happen that we will have legislation in South Africa and the legal framework to expropriate without compensation, basically meaning confiscation. It's the nice word for confiscation. So why would you come and invest as a foreign company into South Africa with the risk of your industrial complex being expropriated, confiscated in a couple of years from now on? It simply doesn't make sense. It will never make sense. So yes, it's that's another thing it's ludicrous to even think that we will see large scale investment in South Africa. The falling rand, it can make it more feasible for investor to come in and then export what is manufactured in South Africa. Seeing that our rand, our currency is falling in value, yes. But you must remember that's very simplistic to look at this. South Africa import most of its crude oil. Now, the moment that our currency drops, it becomes more expensive to buy crude oil. Hence, you have a rise in fuel prices, and you have a rise in anything that needs transportation, producing something without raw material or parts or whatever being transported there. So in other words, yes, maybe on a simplistic level you will have an advantage. But if you look at real economy, at real bottom line cost, even the falling currency discourages people to invest in a country.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, the electricity is more or less non-existent. Eskom is calling for billions and billions of rands to get back up and running, and that's not going to happen overnight, because you don't build power stations overnight. And despite in any event, any money that gets given to South Africa gets stolen by the powers that should not be. So it never goes where it's supposed to go.
Yes, indeed. So we can have all these investments and all this money in Ramaphosa's mind flowing into South Africa, They will just be squandered and siphoned to a certain place that we apparently can't find out where the money is going. Because here's the crazy thing in South Africa. We have even commissions set up by government investigating corruption and investigating the theft and the corruption and where the money has disappeared to. So we know that there's about, at this point in time, it seems more than R1 trillion that is unaccounted for. R1 trillion. It's a tremendously high amount of money. But nobody is arrested for that. Now, if you're the CEO of Eskom, the power utility, and under your watch, hundreds of millions of rands are unaccounted for, then you must be arrested. It's either one of two things. You either stole the money or you lost it through negligence. It's criminal. Both of those are criminal in terms of our Companies Act. That CEO is supposed to be arrested and brought before court and sent to jail.
And
nobody.
Nobody. They get huge bonuses, enormous bonuses. And if they get fired or laid off, then they get golden parachutes, which are even huger bonuses. And nothing happens.
They're just simply being redeployed into some other state-owned enterprise.
Exactly.
I always speak of Idiocracy. That movie Idiocracy. It was an American movie some years ago. That is what we experience in South Africa. It is idiotic state of affairs that normal and rational and sane people, we just can't get our minds around it. We're not supposed to get our minds around it. We know that because it's by design. But the long and the short is, how do you, for instance, rescue an Eskom when this is the situation? So the foreign company will come in, they will invest billions upon billions of dollars, and in 2 years' time, that money is gone. Then what? Who's going to take responsibility and what's going to happen to those people then? So it's not feasible, even if they can do that. In the week, I heard that Richard Branson from Virgin Airlines.
Yes.
Well, he went off to say that, yes, he can invest into SAA and he can turn SAA around. Now, firstly, he can't invest directly into SAA. It's a state and enterprise. It's impossible he can't. So legislation, enabling legislation, will have to be put into place. And secondly, I would assume a parallel company will have to be established that will run certain operations. So number one, with the greatest respect to Richard Branson, he's a big businessman, I'm not criticizing him, but with the greatest respect, he didn't even know those basic things before running his mouth. Now, all the newspapers in South Africa were full now with Richard Branson saying he will turn around SAA. Now, yes, here's the thing, and I can tell this because it's now more than a year and a half later, I can tell this, it's not being unethical towards my clients. I was sitting on a letter of credit from a company from Dubai, which envisaged buying the whole of SAA, not investing into SAA, buying up the whole thing. And the government was not interested in that. So what's the chances now of Richard Branson coming and investing? They will probably say yes to him for investing, because it's going to be his money thrown into a bottomless pit, and they will siphon the money off. But it's not going to save SAA. That I can put on record tonight, and we can speak about it in 5 years' time, and you will see I was right tonight. But it's being given to us now as this beaming light of hope that even the great Richard Branson can see there is potential in South Africa. It's utter nonsense. If this was not a family program, I would have used a word that starts with B. But this is utter nonsense that we are being fed.
Yeah, exactly. And Ramaphosa, well, they call him Ramalaya because, quite honestly, not a word of, well, he's a typical politician, is he not? Not a word of truth comes out of his mouth. But it's really very scary, the economy in South Africa, because while we had some sort of economy, there was a chance for the country. But there is no economy now.
Yes, it's slipping, and one of the mechanisms or one of the ways to see if you're looking at the possibility of a failed state, you must look at what is going on at treasury level. In other words, where the money of the state is kept and budgeted and distributed from there on. And we know that the treasury is basically empty. How do we know this? Because SARS come up to say, SARS is like the IRS in the United States. They would come up last year, I think, and they already predicted at that point in time that the tax that they would take in would not be even close to the levels of taxation that they are supposed to bring in to satisfy the budgets run by Treasury. Now we know that we didn't take in all the tax that was supposed to be taken. So in other words, we know there's a shortfall in the Treasury. We further know about that shortfall because they started to borrow money now. And not in small amounts, they are borrowing in hundreds of billions of rand. And that of course, causes the knock-on effect that we're seeing now that Moody's, for instance, and some of the other ratings company, the national ratings company, came to a point to say, but we're downscaling you now because you're borrowing to basically finance debt that was there already. So you're not borrowing to invest and grow money from that and produce money. It takes a dollar to make a dollar, not on that premise. You're taking money to refinance old debt that you can't pay off. So you're just basically kite flying. In the banking industry, we call it kite flying, where we simply you borrow money from one bank and you pay off your debts at another bank. And then you go to the third bank and you borrow the money and you pay off the second bank. That's basically what's happening here. That's basically what's happening here. So yeah. Yes, Karen, we are in for a very bumpy ride.
Okay, so Skulk, I'd like to change gear. I'm watching the chat room. And Alec97 in the chat room posted a video from 2015 saying the white colonizers, or mass colonizers, our favorite word, are massively getting killed in South Africa. And then I said we were going to discuss the numbers if time allows. And he says, this is not a new film, but in South Africa, there are big problems between white farmers, descendants of the colonialists, and the indigenous black population. All the whites left. The old ones remained. Now, I think for clarity, we need to firstly discuss the indigenous black population and the white colonizers.
Yeah, well, the white, so-called white colonizers were in South Africa before the so-called indigenous black people. We also know that. My family, the Van der Merwe family, arrived in South Africa in 1661. 1661, 1661. We know that because there's a perfect family record as from then. Van Riebeeck arrived in the Cape 6 years before that, 5 years before that, in 1652. When they arrived in the Cape, there was how many black people in the Cape? Zero. Zero. That's a lie. The only people indigenous to South Africa at that point in time were the Khoisan people, which is a smaller, yellowish type of a person. They are not Bantu. They are not black people. And they were living scattered as hunter-gatherers or as nomads, basically across the whole of South Africa. How do we know that black people were not living in the Cape at that point in time? Because 150 years on, we first encountered them on the Fish River, far into the east of the Cape, on the Fish River. And how do we know that? For the very simple reason, there were 11 border wars between the white colonists coming from the south and the black colonists coming from the north. There were 11 border wars between those two groups. That is how we know that black people never lived beyond the Fish River in the Eastern Cape. If that even starts to satisfy your question.
Exactly, Skulk. And that was 150 years after Jan van Riebeeck landed at the Cape. So that should...
Karen, to take this point further, the Zulu nation was only created through Shaka Zulu in the 1810s to 1820s. 1810 to 1820. The Dutch came to South Africa in 1652. More than 150 years before that.
Exactly, Skulk. Okay, so then can we address the second point of that? All the whites left and the old ones remained. Well, yeah, you're not old, and you're still, and you're white as far as I know, and you're still there. And Lee is white, and she's not old, and she's still there. So can we address that as well, please?
So who's the 4.5 million white people living in South Africa then? Are they all old people?
Well,
I don't know. Where did the listener get this information from? And I'm not criticizing. I would have loved to actually.
It's from a video. Yes. It's from a video called White South African Farmers Say They're Living in Fear. It was about a 2015 or 2017 video. But you know how very much the media and the liberals, even white liberal South Africans, distort things. And if you have a British press, for instance, not independent press, but British press or other country press come to South Africa, they also make it, if you listen to Al Jazeera, for instance, you will hear it's the apartheid and white colonials and how we stole the land, etc. We need to, if people are interested enough to listen to our show, and to comment, we need to address their concerns.
Okay, so let me assist this listener even further. The first Boer Republic, the first properly established Boer Republic, was the Republic of Natalia, and that was established in Natal, what is now the province of Natal, between what was then the Zulu Kingdom to the north and to the south, where the Xhosa people. They basically lived. And that area that was declared a republic by the voortrekkers, the Boers, was bought from the Zulu king. From where? Dingaan, Retief, Blood River, all those things. Mapande was his successor. The Boers bought that area from the Zulu people, right? So it wasn't stolen. It wasn't taken by force, anything like that. That was the Republic of Natalia. Natalia was later on taken by the British by force from the Boers, and they simply moved back into the interior where there was nothing, and they established further Boer republics, i.e. the Orange Free State. I still live in the Free State province, which was the old Republic of the Free State. It was declared a republic, I'm not sure the exact date, but it was recognized internationally after 1852, at which time there was no black state beyond the Drakensberg Mountains on the eastern side. You had the Zulu Kingdom and the various Xhosa people living to the south southeast of that. In the interior of South Africa, there was no black state. Full stop. The only black areas were taken as protectorates by the British, and that being Bechuanaland, that is today Botswana. You can go and look at your map, and Lesotho and Swaziland. Those were the only areas black people lived, and the British took that as protectorates. What was the Orange Free State, the Republic of the Orange Free State, was always white. What was the old ZAR, the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republic, the Transvaal Republic, was always white. It was never black land at no point in time.
Yeah, exactly. So thank you, Skulk, for just reinforcing that. Because really, it is one of those false things that everybody seems to say about South Africa. It goes together with what you said earlier about when we talk about white squatter camps or white people being disenfranchised in South Africa, they say we deserved it because of apartheid. And so today's children who are born 25 years after Mandela took over and 40 years after apartheid ended, they deserve what is happening to them today. They deserve to be starved to death. They deserve to be uneducated. They deserve to never have a home. All of those things. It's just sad to me that the indoctrination of the world just keeps on going, and people never get the right history or the right story.
Exactly, Karen. I always throw these liberals off track when they come with this thing of black people in the days of Mandela had no opportunities. They were basically barred from society in toto by the white people. Then I always asked him, but Mandela, what was his profession before he became a politician and before he went to prison? And we will get to that in a moment. But what was his profession? He was an attorney. He was a trained lawyer.
So we now, didn't get the training from him. We didn't educate. We didn't build back schools. We did nothing for them.
Exactly. Oliver Tambo, the other big man of the ANC, what was his profession? He was also a lawyer.
Mahatma Gandhi
was an attorney. They all come from the South African legal fraternity. And you could never become a lawyer if you did not at least go to university and obtain legal degrees. So it means that somewhere Mandela and Oliver Tambo and Mahatma Gandhi and all these big shots, they had to obtain certain degrees, so they had to go to a university. Now, if black people were barred from university, how did that happen? How is that possible? And that throws them off in toto, because for the first time it dawned on them that they are being lied to. They are being simply lied to about what happened in South Africa. Of course, there were black universities. Of course, white taxpayers built universities, Madunsa being one of them, at that point in time, the biggest medical university on earth was built by white people with white tax money for who? The black population under apartheid. Just one example.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at Baragwanath, which was also built by South African white taxpayers for the black people, because white people did not go to Baragwanath, it was one of the most prized teaching hospitals in the world. Doctors would fall over themselves to get a post there so that they could learn about things that they'd never learn anywhere else, because South Africa, being on the dark continent, we had diseases and all kinds of things from all over Africa that they wouldn't see in a civilized country. So they wanted desperately to go there.
Exactly, Karen. The building of whole cities, because sometimes uninformed liberal people think that we stole the whole cities and the whole economy from the black population. Now, okay, where I'm living in the Free State, in the northwestern part of the Free State province, the old Republic of the Orange Free State, no black people lived. Nobody. They didn't live here. There's a very simple reason why they didn't live here. Number one, it's too dry. Number two, it's too cold. It's as simple as that. You will see the distribution of the black population in the wet areas and the semi-tropic areas, because that is the same as where they came from in the Central African, the area around the Great Lakes in Central Africa. So in other words, in this area, no black population was here. Only small numbers, maybe one or two living on a farm. We're not speaking towns or cities. In the 1950s, because of the discovery of gold in the Northwest Free State, a whole new white city was built. Welkom. You can go and study this for yourself. The city of Welkom was built, a white city housing mainly Afrikaner people that was supposed to work on the mines. But then the Oppenheimers realized that they can get people from Lesotho, from the British Black Protectorate, at half or a fraction of the cost to work in the mines vis-a-vis the Afrikaner population. And they started building black cities around all the mining areas here. And that is where the population, the black population of today, comes from in the Free State. White people built these cities for them to come and live as workers. The whole of Soweto, southwestern townships to the southwest of Johannesburg, did not exist as a city. It was built to house the workers coming from the homeland and come and working in the mines and industries of Johannesburg. It was built by white taxpayer money. It was not there in the first place. We built it for them. All infrastructures, which included police stations, which included hospitals, schools, universities, everything, That is where it came from. It wasn't there in the first place. So yes, that's unfortunately the false narrative that was ingrained into the minds of people overseas.
Yeah, exactly, Skalk. So I would like to get back to the farm murders if we can, because you were talking about South Africans in general, not just white South Africans, South Africans in general, living in a humanitarian crisis, an absolute crisis that nobody is looking at, because the numbers of murders in South Africa exceed the number of soldiers, American soldiers, killed in war zones. Now, that is an absolutely frightening statistic that nobody looks at.
Yes, indeed, and we can actually cite numbers, not by so-called conspiracy theorists or right-wingers or Nazis, all these things. We can quote them numbers from the South African police services, which are already doctored to look better. We know that also because in parliamentary sessions that came out. Now, according to those statistics, we're speaking of at least 500,000, 500,000 murders or people dying in violent confrontation with other people since 1994. Half a million. During the whole apartheid era that stretched from 1948 to 1994, we know of 21,000 murders in total for that whole period. After 94 till today, 500,000 people that we know of, according to police stats. Then the IRR. Now, the IRR is the Institute for Race Relations in South Africa. It's a left-wing organization, a left-wing thinking tank in South Africa. They came out with their own studies to show that only 4 out of 10 crimes in South Africa are reported to the police because the police are dilapidated. Now, if you take that and you put it onto the murder statistics, we're speaking of dead people in South Africa due to violence or to a violent death at the hand of another person that maybe will exceed 1 million to 1.1 million people. Now, think for yourself this. More than 1 million people dead because of murder in 25 years. Call me whatever war you want to. Since the Second World War, I can't think of any war, hard war, that produced more casualties, more dead than these numbers. How many people died in Vietnam? I don't know. Maybe you have the statistics.
There were about 60,000 soldiers died.
Karen, that's 10% in Vietnam.
Yes, that went on 20 years. So for me. And I know you said we should talk about more modern wars. But for me, it's a good comparison because that was a 20-year war. And yes. 60,000 American soldiers in a war zone were killed. Now, that is terrible. It really is. It's a horrible figure, and it's a terrible thing that happened. But we are not at war in South Africa.
We're not at war, and that's big irony, because way back, 1994, pre-94, the white population were duped into this thing of, if a war erupts in South Africa, we would lose so many people, and that is why it's better to go and speak to the ANC and find some peaceful solution. Here's another statistic, and you can go and fact-check me on this. During the whole of the Bush War, the Angolan War that South Africa was involved in, we lost less than 1,200 men. 1,200 men. Now, looking back, it's 2020 vision, but maybe we should have opted for a hard war in 1994. Maybe we would have been better off, because I can't envisage half a million to 2 million people would have died in a hard war if things erupted to that point.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you, Skalk, because there were 304,000 wounded in the Vietnam War. Now, if we were to look at those figures in South Africa, attempted murder, aggravated assault, rape, all of those things, if we were to look at those numbers, it would get over the 25 years that the ANC has been in power. I haven't been able to get a total number, but it's way, way beyond that because our rapes exceed that.
Yes, we've become the rape capital of the world. Not me saying this, mainstream media saying this. We've become the rape capital. It's to the extent that even in the black communities, let's leave race out of this and white people out of this. Yes. We're speaking now in general terms of black people experiencing this. Yes. You will find statistics that says it is not a percentage of women being raped. It is how many times in your lifetime you are raped as a black woman. Understand what I'm saying? We're not saying a percentage of black people are raped. We're saying all the black women, most of them, are raped repeatedly during their lifetime. This is how dire it is. Now, if your government is at the point that they can't even protect their women folk, we had this huge outcry that the last 6 months or year about violence against women and children in South Africa, and it's real. It is real. It's not propaganda. The government has even failed their own people, their own constituents, because most black people vote ANC. They've even failed those people because they are experiencing rape and crime and violent death on a daily basis.
Okay, Scott, so if we're going to talk that way, I feel that the ANC has failed its own people in a far worse way than they have failed the whites, because we should have expected what is happening. We should have expected it. And people tried to warn us before the referendum. People, but they were called conspiracy theorists and what by the very government that was at that moment selling us out. So it's a very sad situation that the millions, 40 or 50 or 60 or probably 70 million blacks living in South Africa, have been failed so terribly by their own government and yet still go and vote for them.
They do vote. They do vote. But there's a very interesting number or statistic. If you go and look at the people that stopped voting, and those are the statistics coming from the IEC, there's now more people not voting than people voting. It's because of the percentage-wise, because of the rise in the population, that you still have the ANC gaining 60% of the vote. But you will find that most black people have become totally apathetic to the system and they stopped voting. Most of the young people, the young black people, they stopped voting. What happened in the white community? And the last election saw a lot of white people again voting, and that gained, for instance, the Freedom Front Plus, a huge increase in their vote. But most white people also stopped voting. Now, why would they stop voting? Because the ANC itself was so strong, was so predominant and dominant in South African politics that they always won, and they won with a huge majority. So for a sane and a rational person, thinking to himself, well, if I vote or if I don't vote, it's not really going to make that big a difference. And that's why people stop voting. They were wrong because they can actually outvote via the ANC. But to get those people back to the polls, it's not going to happen. Even if it does happen, for who are they going to vote? Who's still in the running? The EFF, which is actually more left and more genocidal than the ANC. Or the DA, that's also by its own notion a social democrat party. So we're always going to sit with a left wing, at least a social democrat. Social democrat is a nice word for pink communist. We're yes. always going to sit with either pink communist or red communist or red communist. That is always going to be our government in South Africa. We don't have a conservative right. We don't have a Republican party. We don't have anything even closely resembling that in South Africa. So that is the practical problem that we are sitting with.
Skalk, once more, I want to kind of skip to another subject, because once more in the chat room, the same guy is talking about the Russian influence in South Africa, the African nations, Sochi talks, the Russia-Africa summit. where the nuclear-capable bombers made a visit to the continent, and where he announced the cancellation of $20 billion in debt from African countries. Could you give some input on that?
Yes, those are facts. The Russians are moving in big time. Now, why is this happening? Because the Americans have left a power vacuum in Africa. I think that the Americans and the Germans, because those were our two biggest trading partners in years gone by, they expected things to just simply idle along as they were. But it didn't happen in that way. And it was in a huge way or tremendous way caused by the Chinese going into that vacuum and starting to bolster themselves. Now, the Russians aren't stupid. The Russians are stupid, and they saw what was going on. And that is why you have a tremendous new focus of the Russians into Africa, and specifically South Africa. There's a very good reason why the Russians will invest, not only monetarily, but will invest their time and their effort into Southern Africa. Because, number one, it's strategically important for them because it's the middle of most of the sea routes. If oil is taken from the Middle East, it goes around the Cape. You can go with a little bit of oil through the Mediterranean and the Suez Canal, but you can't really do that. And you can bomb the Suez Canal overnight, and that's the end of that sea lane. So most of the oil and most of the minerals from Asia and the trade from Asia and vis-a-vis North America and Europe flows around the Cape. So number one, strategically, if you control the Cape, you basically control 40% of the oceans of the world. But secondly, South Africa is also sitting on tremendously rich reserves of strategic metals and micro metals that in future generations are going to be the most important thing. AI, 5G, 6G, all these things coming up are going to be based on what we have in minerals in South Africa. So it makes sense for the Russians. It makes sense for them to already start to dominate us and recolonize, if you want to, into South Africa. And yes, we had a very blatant display of power by them landing actually old nuclear bombers. It's not the first line anymore, but landing those bombers onto South African Air Force bases, which was a clear sign that they are here even militarily. Involved in South Africa, and expect in a couple of months from now, you're going to see boots on the ground, Russian soldiers in South Africa, as you're already seeing Chinese soldiers in South Africa.
Yes,
these young men coming into South Africa. I sat in a restaurant opposite a bundle of them the other night, and they did not struck me as businessmen. They did not struck me as young people trying to make a living abroad. They struck me as soldiers, clean cut, disciplined, eating like soldiers would eat, speaking in a certain fashion to one another. You can see there's military order, military ranking in that little gathering that they had in that restaurant. And you will see that all over the place. We already have an occupational force by Chinese on South African soil. So yes. It's obvious that the Russians, being clever, they will also do that.
Absolutely, because a while back, may have been 2-3 months back, the Chinese were given permission to open their 13 police stations manned by Chinese for the Chinese.
Yes, it's as simple as that. Now, a policeman can very easily just simply take on a new role, and that being a soldier. So that is why I'm saying we already have Chinese boots on the ground in South Africa. We know that. The Americans are seeing Botswana as their perpetual little Israel type of a situation in South Africa. So obviously very strong in Botswana, not so strong in South Africa. And especially during the Zuma years, now I want to come back to that, but especially during the Zuma years, the American influence in South Africa diminished to a very large extent. Yes, Ramaphosa is more pro-Western to a certain extent because there's money maybe coming from the West, but he's also a communist deep down in his heart. Now, we know the Russians are not communists anymore, but here's the thing. In the olden days, the ANC was sponsored from Moscow. So there's real friendships, real relationships on a personal level, even between the Russians and the ANC. Zuma, being the erstwhile head of intelligence of the ANC, it may seem very strange that stupid Zuma was intelligence officer, but he was the head of intelligence. He was handled by Putin himself. Putin being based in Dresden, in the old DDR, the old East Germany. He ran the African Bureau from Dresden, and Zuma was under his personal control. Putin was the head of Zuma. So obviously, there's going to be a personal relationship between Zuma and Putin, obviously. And therefore, the Russians already have this advantage that very few people or very few other nations have in South Africa.
Absolutely, absolutely. But then again, we have the Chinese. So then we've got these two opposing, supposedly. But then again, you've got BRICS. So I don't really understand. But the Chinese are recolonizing the whole of Africa, and they're doing it through debt, because they are giving huge loans to people like Eskom on condition that if you cannot pay the interest, they take over the whole thing.
Yes, it's a very simple strategy that they are following. It seems very soft, excuse me, and very, very friendly what they are doing. They are simply spurging out money towards the African nations. But they know that there is going to be a point of default. And the moment that they default, that part of the contract, then they take hold over those assets involved in those companies. It's a very simple strategy. It's a very effective strategy. And we're already seeing it in many places in Africa. Tanzania, for instance, very old Chinese involvement there. They basically at this point in time own the whole infrastructure of Tanzania. You can go and fact check these things for yourself. Ethiopia, one of the first places where the Chinese started to become involved, most of the infrastructure of Ethiopia is owned by the Chinese. So yes, the same pattern will repeat in South Africa. Maybe the Russians are a good thing. Maybe they are not a good thing. Maybe it's a check and a balance situation. We will have to see where this thing is going.
Yep. And it's not just South Africa. You have mentioned many, many times how China owns America.
Yes, China owns the treasury of the United States. And many people, when I say these things, they think I'm a conspiracy theorist. And then I point it out to them. Go and study for yourself who own most of the treasury bonds of the United States. Those bonds issued by the treasury, that might be repaid at some point in time. Who owns most of that? China. And not China, even the government of China. Private individual Chinese investors, they tend to go after the American treasury bonds. So in other words, the treasury of the United States is already mostly owned by Chinese. Now, how dangerous strategically is that? Very strategic danger for America.
Absolutely. And in Australia as well, the Chinese influence is huge. They have taken over the farms, they've taken over mines, they've taken over all kinds of things in Australia, New Zealand. It's actually scary that the world is kind of standing by and letting this happen.
Yeah, but who's the counterforce? Trump being maybe the only counterforce at this point in time. The Russians are playing a very, very quiet, as the Russians always do. A very quiet game behind the scenes. They do the things a little bit different. But the only counterweight to China is actually not America, is actually Trump. If we lose Trump, China will dominate the globe within 5 to 10 years from today. Mark my words, if we lose Trump. Trump is the only counterweight. Europe, the European Union, NATO itself, NATO without the US, let's say they go it alone. Macron in the past week was very verbal about this whole thing of Europe must go its own way. I think he sees that American isolationism is growing very, very strongly. But Europe is certainly not a counterpoint to China at this point in time. They are not. They don't have the capability of even taking on the Chinese. So who's the counterweight to China? There is none, except Trump.
There is absolutely none. And Trump is under so much attack and who's got so many problems in his own country that I honestly do not think that he could, even if he wanted to, help South Africa.
I think you sum it up correctly, because we're sitting here frustrated in South Africa. We go to the embassies, we write letters, we send our emissaries to the Americans, and nothing happened. But I think it's a thing of nothing can happen. That's
yes.
Why nothing is. I think that's the scenario that we are facing. Yes.
Absolutely, Scott. We've got about 2 minutes left, but given the impeachment proceedings going on here, and the fact that the Congress has done nothing for 2 years, absolutely nothing, except attack Trump, I don't believe that they can help themselves, much less help anybody else.
Karen, I can foresee maybe three scenarios, but let's discuss only two of them. I can foresee a scenario where they do impeach Trump and they get rid of him, and it sparks a new civil war in the United States. That's
yes.
The one option.
Yes.
The other option is Trump actually becoming, let's say, with a kind of a coup de grace from inside, basically becoming like a dictator in the United States. Those are actually two options, two scenarios that not so far-fetched anymore. If you on my social media, I posted a video of that it was sent to me by one of my American friends of one of his rallies. I'm not sure exactly where it is, but it's a huge football stadium. It's bigger than anything we have in South Africa, and we have huge ones to look at to watch our rugby. You build even bigger ones for your football, and it was packed. 110% people were sitting there like sardines to come and listen to Trump. I can see why the Democrats see a new Hitler in Trump. Not ideologically, maybe, but in practical terms, because he has the nation on his side, and he has it in a tremendous way on his side. For
yes.
him to make one or two moves, he's maybe going to end up as being the first dictatorial president of your history.
Well, on that note, the music is playing. We've come to the end of our show. Same time, same place next week. Thank you very much for listening.